Okay, well, let's look at the coalition election review now. The irony of it all, I guess, is that it was banned. The party did not want to release it. I can't remember a review that's had more attention than this one.
Yeah, it was, mate, you'd think that was a federal executive's first day in politics by sort of trying to suppress it. It was always going to leak. And, of course, in politics, we think a secret is something that you tell one person at a time. So I thought it was incredibly naive. They sort of made a rod from their own back by sort of saying they were going to release it. I'm of the view that you don't need to release these things. They're not the Epstein files. They're not a sort of public right to know. But the report itself, I think, was illuminating. There were many aspects of it, but the one that struck me the most was a breakdown of trust, between the organisational wing and the professional and the leader's office and the leader's staff. Trust as to motivations, trust as to judgment, and trust in each other. So that was probably the most concerning thing. And I think back to, you know, Howard and Lynton Crosby in particular, Howard just trusted Lynton. And there were times where Howard wasn't absolutely certain, but Lynton would say, that's my problem, let me worry about this. And Howard, to his absolute credit, sort of felt that, you know, Lynton's judgment would be right. And now, of course, you know, there's you know, these barriers there. I mean, Andrew Hirst is the federal director. He had an incredibly successful 2019 campaign that was, you know, the impossible win. And 2022, you know, despite the coalition losing quite badly, that was a technically good campaign because Labor only won 7 seats. The Teal phenomenon, which did all the damage, and of course, it made it a very difficult campaign for the Liberal Party because they were fighting on two fronts and dividing resources. The Teal phenomenon wasn't because of 2022 per se and the technical aspects of the campaign. That had its genesis, you know, really 20 years beforehand, where, you know, in some of these Teal seats, they started feeling there was a values disconnect with the Liberal Party and boat people during the Howard government. The same-sex marriage debate in 2016 really did a lot of damage in terms of the values disconnect, where a lot of former Liberal voters in those Teal seats started saying, I don't think this party has the same values as me. And then in 2022, it was like a relationship breakdown, a divorce, like that's when the marriage ended, you know, and they sort of voted for the community independence. So that aside, you know, 2025 was a spectacularly bad campaign, but it's more than just the technical aspects for the Liberal Party. Like, it's the values that they represent. And so even if you have a technically fantastic campaign next time, in all our polling and research, you know, voters are just not warming to the Liberal Party brand at the moment and their priorities and their focus.
If, you know, it was about that, the leaders, there has to be more trust between the leader's office and those running the, who should be running the campaign, that's true. But if you put it out, I mean, that those kind of observations, the white noise of the political dialogue, that's all it is, and it eventually fades away. What they feared mostly about this was the criticism of particularly Angus Taylor, but also the deputy, and because they were, as the Labor now was saying all week in the Parliament, that they were the architects of the poor campaign. But you were never going to hide that. That was kind of known anyway. Everybody knew that was coming.
Yeah,
it's just really put a spotlight on the whole thing.
Yeah.
The other aspect of it that I think that Labor exploited again all week in the Parliament was Tim Wilson, now as the Shadow Treasurer, and he bought these shares during the COVID years as a hedge against the collapse in the share market. Right, you don't really win, but you just don't lose as much if you're hedging against that kind of downturn. But he kept them for a long time.
Yeah.
After COVID, and it leaves him open now. Whenever the government ministers are on their feet and they're talking up the economy and talking up themselves, they can finish by saying, "Don't back against Australia; you'll lose every time." You know, it's a simple line, but it brings in judgment. It brings in patriotism. It's a tough one for Tim Wilson to be hit with right from the outset.
Yeah, Tim's superpower is he has no shame. And as you know,
certainly true.
That's really important in politics. Yeah, it is. Yep. But I've got to say, I saw him in question. I thought, you know, Jim Chalmers crushed him like a paper cup on that. Because he said, Mr. Speaker, I've been wondering why he's been talking down the economy. And then, you know, I saw this article. Performatively, it was very good from Chalmers, and it was one of those rare moments in Tim's career where I've seen him with some shame, and that is going to make it a bit hard for him moving forward. But I've been talking to a lot of Labor friends who are out of the game, but, you know, like Collingwood supporters, they've always got an opinion, you know, armchair coach. They do rate Tim highly, and they think that, you know, he does pose a danger, and part of it is that shamelessness that he's got, but, mate, he just refuses to be knocked down. And, I mean, the fact that he came back and Goldstein, you know, was, I thought he was mad doing it, but he won. So.
Yeah, no, he's extremely articulate. You know, wonder at the end of some of it that, you know, what did he just say? But he sounds convincing.
Yeah.
You mentioned climate change before, and it was mentioned in the review only in passing, but an interesting mention just the same. It said that young people can be alarmed by false claims, as many have been on climate change. But the most overriding concerns of most of them are closer to home, owning a house and having a job. So the only context in which climate change was mentioned was to say, well, there are false claims and kids are gullible, you know, and they're lapping it up. That issue, I think, was the lead issue in terms of the Teals taking about 9 seats from the coalition. I don't think that's the kind of analysis that's going to help them much on that issue.
Yeah, that is one of the problems of the Liberal Party, is that it's got to be seen to be credible on climate change and reducing emissions in those Teal seats. And, you know, I keep on talking, Barry, about the fragmentation of the electorate. You know, I go back to the mid-90s, and really what worked in North Queensland worked in Sydney and worked in Perth. Now we're a nation of smaller and smaller tribes, and so it's very, very hard to pitch a message. And, you know, some of the feedback I've been getting from wise heads in the Labor Party and the Liberal Party over the last month or so is, can a political party ever get back up to 40%? We're all looking at this phenomenon of basically one nation eating into not just coalition territory, but they're now eating into Labor territory. Looks like they took 2 points off Labor federally. And in Victoria, we had a poll out this week. Victoria's dropped 6 points for Labor. One Nation has gone up to 24. They look like they've taken 12 points off the coalition, which is savage.
And this is Victoria we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, which is, you know, it's
not Queensland.
No, it's California. It's Massachusetts, you know. Mm. And so One Nation are starting to really change the landscape dramatically. And I guess everyone, the $64,000 question is, how enduring is this?
Yeah. We've got a question from Sean, who emailed, and he said, we focus on the House of Representatives a lot around this. But he's interested in the implications in the Senate. Could they get to the point where they can affect the passage of legislation in the Senate? Well, the simple answer to that is they sure can, without very much of a shift, because there's 76 senators, in 38 is half of that, 39, that's Labor and the Greens at the moment, 39, bare majority, but they control it. So the non-Labor parties, the non-Green parties, can very easily suddenly get control. The trick is, though, that One Nation can take seats away. If they just take them away from the coalition, then that doesn't change the balance. They'd need to take seats away from Labor as well, but not many, just a few, and they will have control over the, or significant influence over the legislation.
Well, I think that can start eating into the left territory as well, and look with preference flows and order of exclusion. You never know what sort of Senate you'll find. And remember, last federal election was the first time ever that the coalition only won 2 spots in every state. They didn't win a third spot. Not long ago, they used to traditionally win 3 in every state. And then it was 2 in some states, 3 in others. So we could be entering an era where the coalition might not even win 2 spots in one state. Yeah. I don't think that's implausible at the moment if this voting behaviour continues.
And if that goes to One Nation, that changes the balance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The other thing too is, if they do expand Parliament, and I'm still a sceptic, I don't think it's going to happen. I think there's valid arguments for it. But if they expand House of Reps, they need to expand the Senate. And, of course, it needs to be in multiples of 2 because of half Senate. And so if you have an expanded Senate, the quota to get elected is lower.
Mm.
So suddenly 6% primary vote in the Senate, which is not enough for a quota, depending on how many senators you've got. But it's traditionally, you know, not enough. But suddenly it puts you very, very competitive because a few preferences and you've got a quota.
And from a federal point of view, when you're looking at the South Australian election just around the corner, the what would interest you the most? Would it be the flow of preferences, where they're going in regard to One Nation?
Yeah, we asked in Victoria and federal in the last week respondent allocator preferences. So we actually asked respondents on the survey how they distribute their preferences. We don't always ask that because what they call historical preference flows are normally incredibly reliable. For example, green votes, around 85% flow back to Labor when they're excluded. And that's almost every election without fail. One Nation typically has been between 75 and 77% of One Nation votes flow back to the coalition once they're excluded. But now we're in this situation where One Nation might get over the top of the coalition in some seats, particularly in those regional peri-urban seats. What was really interesting in our survey, and there was an identical number for both state and federal, they were separate samples, was that there was 31% leakage of coalition votes. So if coalition were excluded first, 31% leaked to Labor over One Nation. So I guess people like me, I would put my preference to Labor over One Nation. So 31% it's a big leakage.
It is.
Yeah, yeah. It's enough to cause a bit of damage.
People talk about directing preferences. They can't direct. They can just suggest. That's
yeah.
all.
Yeah.
And that's what happens.
Yeah.
You get a 30% leakage. Your colleague Cosmaris talked this week about forget precedent now. That's how dramatically politics has changed. You can't even rely on precedent anymore. But here's an example of how accurate that is. The last time that there was an election in Farrer, at the general election, the independent candidate, Michelle Millthorpe, came in second. She came in second to the Liberal candidate who went on to lead the Liberal Party,
yep.
Susan Lee. This time, it'll be just on, almost bang on, 12 months after that, and the contest this time is Michelle Millthorpe versus the toughest opponent, the One Nation candidate.
Yep.
What a dramatic shift in just 12 months.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's going to be a fascinating election. I think it's a great opportunity, though, for the Liberal Party. The Nationals have said they won't run, which I think is wise because it's just going to cannibalise that Conservative vote, and you can't always be, even with preferencing between National Party and the Liberal Party in those three traditionally three-cornered contests, it's still only about 90%, so you still have leakage with that. So that was a wise decision, I think. But it's a great opportunity for the Liberal Party, though, to get out there and actually get rid of some of that campaign rust and establish their credentials again, campaigning on the ground, which is going to be very, very important. But
they're going to be asked constantly about One Nation.
Exactly.
And I think it's how they deal with that.
Yeah. The preferences decision, already Jess Wilson in Victoria has ruled out doing a deal with One Nation, which I think was very wise. But interestingly, in South Australia, One Nation have come out and said, we won't be doing any deals. Mm. And I think that's part of their brand. And in some of the research we see, it's because One Nation voters, about 21% are specifically voting for One Nation because of the two-party system. They hate it when we ask them, and I'll get to that in a sec. So I think if she did a deal with the major parties, it'd be evidence to some of these voters that she's actually just part of the two-party system. And I think separating herself out was strategically quite smart because in the last survey we did, that 28% of federal voters who said they were voting One Nation this time, we then separated them out and asked them individually, why are you voting One Nation? And we asked them open-ended questions. So instead of giving them a laundry list of different options to choose from that we think might be motivating them, we let them put it in their own words. And then we coded them. And I thought what was really interesting was 21% of people voting One Nation said they're doing it because they hate the two-party system. And some of them actually use those words, which is, it's a bit insiderish talk, but they hate the major parties.
Yep.
15% said because of immigration policy. They like her immigration policy. 14% said because they like Hanson. She's the truth teller. She tells my truth. It's that authenticity. Like, she tells it the way she sees it. You know, the other leaders just sort of, you know, they'll tell you what you want to hear and so forth. 12% said it's because Australia's heading in the wrong direction and we need real change. They don't see the major parties is offering that real change. And 12% said nationalism. So it was a really interesting insight as to what's motivating those One Nation voters. You know, it's difficult to tell how much of it is protest, how much of it is power, how much of it is just parking it there. And, you know, to use your excellent example just recently about the Xenophon Party, You know, they were at 34% on News Poll and they crashed to 14. But Barry, I'm just seeing more and more evidence in these focus groups that this might be more enduring than we think.
All right. Well, what we must, I think, as a country, ensure is that some of the politics of Trump that are normalised in the United States are not normalised there, and that's why I dedicate myself each week, if I can, to point out something about One Nation.
Yep.
Just this week, you talk about, you know, she's authentic, she tells the truth. Just a couple of facts from this week. One Nation, the New South Wales senator from One Nation lived in Queensland when he was first chosen, and he lived there for 4 months after his appointment, senator for New South Wales living in Queensland. And then Pauline Hanson at Submerge charged taxpayers $9,000 for a private plane to go to a function that was thanking Gina Rinehart for a community donation. Just a couple of things that occurred this week that I think you should know about.
And I think the really important thing for the coalition, there'll be a temptation from some corners of the coalition to do a deal with One Nation for preferences in Farrer. And I think that would be a terrible mistake strategically. I think, firstly, it helps legitimise One Nation when they should be going on the attack. You look back at Howard and Costello, and we spoke recently about 2004 where One Nation didn't win a Queensland Senate spot because Ron Boswell on the ground, the late Ron Boswell, campaigned hard on the ground, but then Costello and Howard provided that macro air cover on those. They destroyed her economic credentials.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to delegitimise them. But also, I think it looks weak and defeatist if they cut a deal with One Nation, which is not the sort of message you want to be sending to voters, where they're looking and seeking for strength from their leadership.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it removes that campaign rust, as we said. But more importantly at the moment, you know, there's coalition members who can probably live with some of her immigration policies. And that's all fine. Let's park that to one side. But she's probably going to come up with some truly crazy policy ideas soon. And the coalition will own it because she'll effectively be the deputy leader,
yeah.
not David Littleproud.
Yeah.
And I know that's, you know, that's the way how the media will portray it, and they're going to have to deal with it. So it'll be a real test of whether they're being strategic or tactical.
Well, that's it for this week. This podcast was made on the lands of the Wurundjeri people. It was produced by Daniel Simo and video production Burton Hewin.
Executive producer is Hannah Parks.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry. And this is Back to Back Barry's, a Guardian Australia podcast.